And we're holding on Kuf Yud Amr Aleph, the second line. We started learning yesterday about the kal, the udder of an animal, which contains milk and the glands, of course. And the question is, what needs to be done in order to make it kosher to eat? So we discussed that the Mishnah had said that you have to rip it open and get the milk out. And he said in the Gemara, the ripping is supposed to be, according to the mainstream understanding there, we said with Shesi Ve'erev, you tear it lengthwise and widthwise and press it against the wall in order to, against some kind of hard surface in order to get out as much of the milk as possible. We talked about, what about if you didn't do that, the Di'evet, would it be mutter or not? Is it mutter even to Rabbanon? Or we had a version of what Rav said, that if he didn't tear it before cooking it, then it would be mutter d'araisa, but still also to Rabbanon. We talked about, is there a difference between that regard between roasting and cooking? And we had various details about that. In any case, though, the point is that we had one vote. So Rashi explains the following piece of Gemara is going to be based on the fact that we had a second version of Rav that says that if a kal, that if this udder was cooked without tearing it open, then even though daraisa, it would be mutter, but the rabbanon it would be also. From the Tosfos, we discussed that it might be that it itself is mutter, but we're talking about whether other pieces of meat that were cooked with it would be mutter. In any case, so the Gemara says, Kisolik Rebbe Lozer, when Rebbe Lozer went up from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael, Ashchele Ze'iri, he met Ze'iri, one of the Talmid Chachamim over there, Amalei, and he asks him, Tika Tana de Asnia le Rav Kachal. Is there the Tana over here who taught Rav about the Dina of Kachal, the Braisa that we said before, that we learned yesterday, that if you cooked it without whipping it, then it's going to be also to eat. Again, according to Rashi, we mean cooking as opposed to roasting, and according to Tosfos, we mean cooked with other meat. In any case, Rebbe Lozer is wondering why Rav would say such a thing. So can you show me, Ze'iri, the Tana, meaning not a Tana as in like the generations of Tanoim, but a Tana as in one who is expert in Braises and would repeat them over in the Beis Medrash. Can you show me the one who taught this Braise to Rav? I'm thinking there might be something wrong with how he taught it to him. So the locals showed him Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Avudimi, that he was the one. Tosfos interestingly points out, goes into a little detail over here, there seems to have been in the Gemara two different Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Avudimis. One of them is the one we're talking about over here, who had been around in the time of Rebbe and was still around. Rav was one of Rebbe's Talmidim, and he had taught him, and he was still around in the next generation. But then there was another one. So actually, Tosfos says that there would have been one in the times of Rebbe, and now another one that would be who was Rav's Rebbe. Those are fairly close together, but the Tosfos points out that it doesn't seem a different Gemara also mentions Rava saying something in the name of Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Avudimi, and Rava lived several generations later, so how would that work out? So it seems that there may have been at least two Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Avudimis. Be that as it may, so they showed him, or the Rashash points out, it sounds like Ze'iri himself showed him Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Avudimi. So again, Rashi says the question was, according to Rav's second version, that if you don't rip it, that if you don't tear it before cooking it, then it's going to be also, by itself, according to Rashi, with other meat, according to Tosfos, why is that? It can contain milk, but it doesn't necessarily contain milk. It depends whether the animal is nursing or not. So why is he so machmir? Tosfos says that no, it's just in general, as we're going to learn soon in the Gemara, Rav held and taught the people above us that now that the odor is generally also, even with this whipping, even with this pressing, even with all of that, Rav was answering it to the people above us. So Rabbi Lozer thought he must have learned that during his years in Eretz Yisrael. He must have learned a braisa to that effect from one of the Tanoim, and now he wants to know who taught him such a braisa. So Rabbi Lozer goes over to talk to Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Avudimi. Amalei, and Rabbi Yitzchak tells him, "Ani lo shenisi like kal kol iker." No, I didn't actually teach him anything about the kal at all. How did Rav come on the schumra that there should be, as we learn according to Rashi, that if you cook it without tearing, it's going to be osur, and according to Tosfos, that if you cook it without, and according to Tosfos, that uh, that that chal should be also altogether. So the reason is Rav bika motza begada begeder. Rav found an open valley and made a fence around it. Meaning we know the chachamim have the responsibility. Yes, to siyag la Torah. So we find examples where chachamim would come to a certain place and find that people are careless for a certain mitzvah or a certain aspect of Yiddishkeit, and therefore they would make fences around it. There's a number of letters, actually, where the Rebbe used to quote this, a number of letters in Sichas where the Rebbe used to quote this line from the Gemara and say, you see from that, many people take the view that, you know, if you see people being careless with a certain aspect of mitzvahs, then it shows, you know, you got to go easier on them. You got to be matzer things for them. You got to find heterim for things, because as it is, they're not keeping it. But we see on the contrary here, Rav didn't say, well, you're being careless. Fine, you know, let's find a way around it so you can continue doing what you're doing, and at least you'll keep to whatever you can. No, on the contrary, he made a fence and demanded that they keep an even stricter standard than is required of Yalom. Namely, so what happened? The Rav Ikl of Tatalfush. One time Rav visited a place called Tatalfush, or Tatalfush, however we pronounce. Shamalai, and it was a town where there were Jews living over there, but Shamalai, he itza to call Malachavita. He overheard one woman, a Jewish woman, saying to another one, Riva de Bisra, a quarter liter of meat, a couple of ounces of meat, Kamachalova boi lavashuli. How much milk do you need for this recipe in order to cook it? Omar, so he realizes to himself, like, maybe the boss of a cholov also, look at this, these Jews over here, they're so ignorant of Torah, they don't even know that boss of a cholov is also. So he stayed there a while to start teaching them Torah. And in the course of that, he declared to them that chal is osur when it was cooked with milk. So again, according to Rashi, when it was cooked with milk, with the milk in it, without tearing it open, even to the Eved, even though, as we learned yesterday, there might be reasons to say that it's mutter, and according to Tosfos, b'chlal, he asked them the other altogether. Either way, the point is, this way it should be a permanent reminder to them to be careful of the halachas of bosa b'chalo. So therefore, so in other words, Rav Yitzchak Bar Avdimi saying, this is not something that Rav learned in Eretz Yisrael. This is something when Rav came to Bavel, he discovered that there were Amir Oretz over there, and therefore he declared the halacha to be this. We find, by the way, in a number of places in Shas, we find that when Rav came to Bavel, it's considered like the beginning of a new era in the history of the Jews of Bavel. We find a number of places where the Gemara mentions the key also Rav the Bavel. Ever since Rav came to Bavel, then such and such. So it was like a watershed moment. It was like a beginning of an epoch. It was like the beginning of a new era in the history of the Jews of Bavel, that a top level Talmud Chacham, a world class Talmud Chacham like Rav. I mean, they had Talmud Chacham in Bavel before that as well, but that Rav came from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel and started working on upgrading the Yiddishkeit, the level of Yiddishkeit over there. So that became like people thought of it as like a new era in the history of the Jews of Bavel. Somewhat like, you know, you have in our times, for example, or close to our times, you have, let's say, you know, in the early 1940s, you know, you have the Friedrich Rebbe came to America, and we Lubavitch of Chassidim consider that to be a new era in history. A little bit after that, for example, Rabbi Aaron Kotler came to America and opened Beis Medrash Gavoya, the famous Lakewood Yeshiva, and that also became like a, you know, so you have a certain time when great Talmid Chachamim come to a place that until now had relatively little Torah in it, and a new era begins over there. So it is over here. How did it come about, by the way, that there's places in Bavel like that was so ignorant? The Dodos HaRishonim, a sefer on Jewish history, has an interesting explanation of it. He traces it to a story that Josephus tells that happened actually about 200 years before Rav's times. The gist of it is that there were two Jewish brothers who became leaders of a troop of outlaws. Eventually they were fighting on behalf of the government, but eventually they fell out with the government, and there was a whole pogrom against the Jews over there. And then the result is he learns that as a result of that, there were many Jews in that area who were forced to be living as Jews somewhat secretly, maybe not outright as Maranos, like they have to totally pretend to be Goyim, but at least to the extent that their Yiddishkeit was there, their knowledge of Torah and Yiddishkeit was severely weakened, and now eventually Rav came there and discovered that this was the case. Okay, so that's one answer of why Rav was so machmir on the other. Rav Kahana Masmi Hokhi. Rav Kahana had a different version of what Rav Yitzchak Bar Avdimi told Rav Elazar. He said, Rav Kahana Masmi Hokhi. That is how Rav Kahana learned the story that Rav Elazar had asked Rav Yitzchak Bar Avdimi, and Rav Yitzchak told him that Rav did not learn any such thing in Eretz Yisrael. He came to Bavel, found that they were Amir Oretz, and he was machmir on them like that. Rabbi Yossi bar Abba Masni Hoffman. On the other hand, Rabbi Yossi bar Abba Masni. On the other hand, Rabbi Yossi bar Abba has a different version of what Rabbi Yitzchak bar Abba Dumi's answer was. He says, "I'm not chal shem nika shem isulav." When I told him these chumras about the chal, about the udder, I didn't say that any kind of udder. I said dafka when the animal is nursing, when the mother animal is nursing, and that its udder is full of milk. So then you have these dinim that we can talk about before, that we said that if you didn't cut it open, if you didn't press out the milk, etc., then it can be also, because you have so much milk in there, you would have reason to say that it's also dirabana. Only popula shall Rav Chiya, but because of the shortness of Rav Chiya, shana like chal stam, Rav Chiya, when he taught Rav, taught him just about chal without specifying. Namely, Rashi and Tosfos both explain that what it means is basically Rav Chiya was very, very sharp and knowledgeable in Torah. He thought that his talmidim are equally knowledgeable. So when Rav Chiya taught Rav and his other talmidim, Then he taught them that he taught them the dinim about a chal, and he expected that Rav Chiya expected that his talmidim, including Rav, would understand that obviously the chumras we're talking about are talking about the udder of a lactating animal which is full of milk. And meanwhile, what happened was that Rav thought it refers to a chal in general. So Rav Yitzchak bar Abba Dumi, according to the second version, is telling Rav Elazar the reason why Rav is machmir on a chal. That if you didn't tear it, it's also even b'di'evad that I bought on according to Rashi, or that chal is outright also according to Tosfos, is because he didn't quite understand. He learned by Rav Chiya this din about chal, but he didn't realize that there's a distinction between a lactating and a non-lactating animal. So more on this topic. The Gemara says, Ravin and Rabbi Yitzchak bar Yosef iklu lebeit Rav Papi. One time Ravin and Rabbi Yitzchak bar Yosef one time visited the house of Rav Papi. Aisha would come out, Tavshila de Kral, and they brought them a cooked dish made of udder. Rabbi Yitzchak bar Yosef aha, Ravin lay aha. Rabbi Yitzchak bar Yosef ate from it, Ravin did not. Now why didn't Ravin eat it? Omer Abaye. So when Abaye heard about it, he said, Ravin tichla, Ravin the bereaved. Rashi points out that Ravin unfortunately lost his children. His children passed away young, and therefore he was called Ravin Tichla. We have another Gemara in Pesachim where also Abaya calls him that. Now, why would he call him that? I mean, if it's to his face, it would certainly be a terrible thing to do, to always remind him of his loss. But even if it's not to his face, why is Abaya keying on that? So there's a couple of different explanations. One of them is the Gemara tells us in Brachos that you have something called Yisurim Shel Ava. You have when a person has suffering that happens for no other reason than because Hashem loves him and wants to bring him to a higher level, not because of any aveiros he was doing. So therefore, Abaya then would be saying about Ravin that he's on that level. He's on that level of Yisurim Shel Ava, and therefore we have now we're even more surprised that Tzaddik and a Talmid Chacham like him, why would he not eat from this? Another way of looking at it, another understanding of it, is that it means that based on Yerushalmi, is that Ravin was not only had lost his children, but he had also lost his parents before he was born. His father passed away before he was born, and then his mother in childbirth, which Abaya was the same kind of thing, which the Gemara points out in Kiddushin when it talks about Kibbud Avraham, that Kibbud Avraham is such a tremendously difficult mitzvah to do that in a way a person is better off if he's in that situation. He never knew his parents, and therefore he has much less of an issue with Kibbud Avraham with them. So then according to that, then Abaya would be mentioning that about Ravin again, you know, as a compliment. In other words, look how perfectly he's able to be mekayim in the mitzvah of Kibbud Avraham, like me myself. Abaya was also in that situation, unlike most people who have a very hard time with that. In any case, Abaya says, why did Ravin not eat from this dish over here that they were served in Rapapi's house? Nechti, let's consider, Dvesu did Rapapi brate did Rav Yitzchak Napcha Avoy. Rapapi's wife is the daughter of Rav Yitzchak Napcha. Rav Yitzchak Napcha mori de Uvda Hava. And Rav Yitzchak Napcha was known to be a mori de Uvda, literally means the master of good, means the master of deeds. Rashi says, in other words, he's zohar b'maisim tojim. You know, he's very, very careful in every area of halacha. So he loved the Shmuel and Rebbe Nosha. So if Rav Papi's wife, Rav Yitzchak Napcha's daughter, had not heard from her father's household that such a thing is allowed, loy hava avda, she wouldn't have done it. So therefore, in other words, in short, Abaya is saying that Ravin should have relied that Rav Papi's wife knows what she's doing, and if she's preparing them a dish of chal, of udder, that she's known, that she knows what she's doing, and she definitely prepared it in a way that's mutter, and therefore Robin shouldn't have avoided eating it, says Abaya. Okay. More on this topic. So now the Gemara explains there were actually different places. It turned out there were different places where they had different minhagim about eating the udder or not. Again, as we said before, Rav came to a certain area in Bavel, and because they had been careless with Bas v'Cholof, therefore he declared for them that the udder is altogether usur. So now the result of that is the Gemara says, "Bisura le'achli kafli." In Sura, one of the major cities in Bavel, which is where Rav set up his yeshiva, they did not eat udder. So Rav again had been machmer on them because of the amir oretz in that area. So even though he upgraded their level of Yiddishkeit and taught them about Bas v'Cholof, nevertheless for all time he asked them to eat udder. So in Sura, when they shechted animals, they would throw out the udder. As the Gemara is going to go on to say, they wouldn't eat them. On the other hand, in Pumpadissa, where you had the other great yeshiva of Bavel, then they would eat the udder because they'd never had such amaraxis there in the first place. We are going to talk about later on in the next paragraph. We're going to talk about Pumbedissa had other problems as far as the midas of certain people who live there. But as far as amaraxis, they didn't have that, and therefore there was no reason to make such a gzeira over there. So the result is it was a minig, different minhagim in different places, whether to eat it or not. Well, that led to the following story. Rami bar Tamri, who was also known as Rami bar Dikuli, Tamri means dates, Dikuli means palm trees, so his father may have been known by both names, the date or the palm tree. There's a different Gemara, actually, where this Amora is also mentioned, and there you have a different Gersa that Rami bar Tamri was the father-in-law of Rami bar Dikuli. In any case, the point is, so this Rami, he was from Pumbedissa, and as we're going to see soon, he was a Talmud of the Yehuda, who was a Rosh Hashiva in Pumbedissa. Ikla the Sura, one time he visited the Sura, the Mala Yom Kippur, on Erev Yom Kippur. Now, as we learned earlier in the Masechta, Erev Yom Kippur is a time when people shecht an unusually large number of animals because they're all having meat for the Suddah before Yom Kippur. We talked about actually earlier when we talked about Oseh Vesvano, that it was primarily in the Golil, north of Eretz Yisrael, that they did it, as opposed to in the south of Eretz Yisrael and in other places, they shechted mainly birds. And in fact, it mentions in Shulchan Aruch in the halachas of the Suddah and Masechta that better you should have more easily digestible foods, such as chicken, rather than foods that are harder to digest, like beef. So over here, either in Surah, they didn't worry about that. Or we're talking about, again, you have to have a few meals on Erev Yom Kippur, so this might have been for one of the earlier meals in the day. In any case, people had shechted animals. Everybody took out the kachal and threw it away, because again, this is Surah, this is where Rav had his yeshiva, and therefore, so the local din is that the udder is also, so they all threw them out. Also, so now he, Rami, went and gathered the naktinu, so he went and gathered them up, achlinu, and he ate them. So, chavinu v'achlinu, which says on the side, he roasted them, and he ate them. I saw the Kameh de Rav Chisda. So they brought him to Rav Chisda. The locals saw him doing that. Wait a minute, this is a place where udders are also. Are you talking? You're eating something that's not kosher. So they brought him to Rav Chisda. So they brought him to Rav Chisda that Rav Chisda should punish him for violating the local minhag. In fact, Dukhe Sofim on our Gemara, Dukhe Sofim is a sefer that collects many different manuscript variations of the Gemara. He even brings from a manuscript that they actually already say they started tying up this Rami ready to give him Malchus. But first, Omalei, so Rav Chisda says, "Amai Tevin Hochi, how could you do that? This is a place where we don't eat udder." Omalei, so Rami says, "That's not a problem." And they ask for Rabbi Yehuda. No, I come from where Rabbi Yehuda is, the Rosh Hashiva in Pumbedissa. And there the minhag is that we do eat udder. Omalei, so Rav Chisda says, "Veles lach nois nirol chumra amokim sheyotzim isham v'chumra amokim shalach nesham." Don't you know? Don't you hold of what it says in the Mishnah? Don't you follow what it says in the Mishnah that if a person travels from one place to another, he has to follow the chumras of the place he came from and the chumras of the place that he goes to? So fine, you come from Pumbedissa where they're nakel, but you're now in Surah, so therefore you have to follow the rules of Surah. So how could you do that? Now you have different details in that regard. It's not so simple to always say that you just have to follow the chumras of the place. There is one consideration is whether you're planning to settle there permanently or whether you're only staying there for a while. So we'll talk about that later on. We'll talk about the Bezat Hashem, something Nachsam Sofer says about the story that from which we're going to see that the answer is that in fact he was only planning to stay there temporarily, and therefore he's not obligated to, and therefore that was his answer. So he's not. But still, Rav Chista tells him, don't have to follow the local minhagim. Amalei, so Rami Bar Tami says, chutz l'tchum ha'chaltinim. If I'm outside the tchum, the whole concept that you have to keep the minhag ha'mokim applies only when you're in the town. But here I was outside the town, outside the tchum, and therefore I'm not bound by the local. So if I was planning to settle here, it would be one thing, but I'm not, and I'm just visiting, and therefore I'm entitled to still follow my local minhag ha'pumpadisa and eat the kal. Okay. Rav Chista says, fine, I can understand that. Okay, it's raw meat. You had to prepare it somehow. Over met to be sinu. What do you roast them with? It's well outside the city. So we had to find wood for the purpose. Now that Amban explains at this point, on the face of it, the discussion should have been over. Fine, he's allowed to eat the kral, and that's that. You would think, doesn't Chista have better things to do on Erev Yom Kippur? But he wanted to, the fact that he'd been over on the minhag, so he wanted to see if he could trip him up in something, this way at least he could tell him, look, fine, I'm not going to punish you for this, but at least next time don't do such things that are going to cause people to wonder about you. Meanwhile, Rami was very, very sharp, and always had an immediate answer on the tip of his tongue, as the Gemara is going to go on to tell, and therefore, so everything that Rav Chista throws at him, he's able to answer right back. So he asks him, of Matavisinu, what did you roast him with? Amalei, so Rami says, Bepurtini, I used kernels of grapes that were left there by the wine presses, and I made a fire out of those. So Rav Chista says, you're doing with Yain Nesach, what about if those, maybe those kernels were from grapes that had been pressed for Yain Nesach, and Yain Nesach is also Bahana. Omalei, so Rami says, that's not a problem. They were very, very dry. They'd been there for at least 12 months. And we learn in Masechta Avodah Zarah that if they're only when they're moist, which means they still have moisture of wine in them, would they be osur as Yain Nesach. Once they're completely dry, which is defined as after 12 months, then they're mutter. Well, says Rami, it was evidently after 12 months. So therefore, there'd be no problem of Yain Nesach. So Rav Chista asked the Duma de Gezel Haba, okay, but maybe it's stolen, maybe somebody owned these grape kernels. Amalei, these grape seeds. Amalei, so Rami says, no, Yush Bailam Haba. It's clear the owners had given up hope of ever getting them back. They were master them. And they weren't going to bother with them. I could see that there were weeds and thorns growing among them. And if they left them, they were that. So they'd already, Rashi explains, they were rotting away and then practically becoming dust. So at that point already you could see, and nobody is coming to get back this pile of grape kernels. Next, Chazya Gala have a manach tefillin. Rav Chista noticed that Rami Bar Tamri is not wearing tefillin. And in those times, they used to wear tefillin all day long. Omalei, so Rav Chista says, my time alay manachas tefillin. Why aren't you wearing tefillin? Doesn't that show that you're being careless with mitzvahs? Omalei, so Rami answers, cholim ayin, because I have stomach trouble. He had to go to the bathroom very often. The Omer of Yehuda, and Reb Yehuda, who was Rami's Rebbe, said, cholim ayin, potter min tefillin, that somebody who has intestinal trouble is potter from tefillin. Rashi says, because he's constantly going to have to take them off. Every time he has to run to the bathroom, he's going to have to take them off. Tosfos elsewhere explains a different reason is because during tefillin you have to be careful with guf noki. You have to be careful to keep a clean body, and in particular that means not to pass gas while you're wearing them. Well, with an intestinal disorder like that, Rami knew he's not going to be able to. Therefore, he does not. Therefore, he should not wear tefillin until he's cured. An interesting point, by the way, in this regard, is that it comes out and poor Rami Bar Tamri, he's got stomach troubles, he doesn't even have, as the Gemara is going to go on to say next, he didn't even have clothing of his own, he had to borrow clothing, as we're going to say next in the Gemara, and here is Erev Yom Kippur, and he's in a Jewish town, you would think he should at least go maybe and knock on somebody's door and ask to be invited in for the Yom Kippur, for the Erev Yom Kippur Soda. So there's a vote on this from the famous Baal Musar of Chaim Shmuel Levitz that says, you see how far a person should go to not take tzedakah from others, to not depend on others, even if it means he's going to have to be outside the city, taking discarded pieces of meat and using half rotted away grape seeds in order to roast them, and he can't even afford his own clothing and so forth. It's worth it to do that rather than depend on somebody else to help support him. Okay. Anyway, so the Gemara continues. Next, Rav Chista noticed that the Sirami Bar Tamli is not wearing tzitzis. He's not wearing strings on his tzitzis, and he's wearing a four-cornered garment, and there's no strings on it. Amalei, so Rav Chista says, my time alas lachoti, why don't you have tzitzis strings? Amalei, so Rami answers, talus sh'ulihi, because this is a talus that I borrowed, it's not my own. Now, we're not talking about it, the Chassam Sofer points out at this point, I mean, Rav Chista is well aware there's many reasons why a beged could be potter from tzitzis. It could be ksus laila, as we learned about in Menachos. It could be a garment which is primarily meant to be worn at night. But he's asking, look, you seem to be a Talmid Chacham, you should be machna on yourself, even things that are potter, so therefore, why don't you put tzitzis on it? And so Rami is answering that it's borrowed, and therefore, so I can't be machmer on myself, because then I'm changing something in the beged that I borrowed from somebody else, and I can't do that. I can't be machmer on somebody else's expense. And he continues, Omer of Yehuda, and Rabbi Yehuda, who again was his Rebbe, had said, Talus Shu'ula, Kol Shloshin Yom, Turim Anatzitzis. If you borrow a talus throughout the whole first 30 days, it's potter from tzitzis. Tosfos points out that Midaraisa would be potter forever because we're going to learn later on in the Masechta that we're going to talk briefly about the din of tzitzis over there, and the Gemara is going to point out over there that the din of tzitzis, Midaraisa, applies only to clothing that you actually wore, that you actually own. But here, the Chachamim said, once you have it for 30 days, it already appears like you own. It's not so obvious that it's borrowed anymore, and because normally people borrow things for 30 days, and therefore, for up to 30 days, and therefore, and therefore 30 days and onward, you would have to put on tzitzis. That leads Tosfos into some interesting discussions about various details of the dinim of tzitzis that are relevant to here and that come out of this. One thing is, Tosfos says, if you borrow somebody else's tzitzis, then maybe you shouldn't say bracha on it. Because we're saying over here that you're not chayim to put tzitzis on it. Because Tosfos says maybe you shouldn't say a bracha on it. However, then Tosfos says if somebody makes a bracha lo hifsid, then he hasn't lost out. In practice, in the halachas of tzitzis, you have if you borrow somebody else's talus, then in principle, yes, as we're saying over here, because it's borrowed, you don't have to say a bracha. We touched on this actually, and when we were discussing the halachas of the chazan puts on a talus for slichus. So then we said that better he should borrow somebody else's talus, and then that way there's less of a suffix whether to make a bracha. Because when you borrow somebody else's talus, there is grounds in halacha to say that you shouldn't make a bracha. However, on the other hand, you could make a bracha, as Tosfos is saying, lo hifsid, you haven't lost out by that. And the general minhag is, when you borrow somebody else's talus, you are technically allowed to borrow somebody's talus on an ad hoc basis, even without their permission, because we assume that somebody would want a mitzvah to be done with their money, as long as it doesn't hurt with their property, as long as it doesn't hurt them financially. You do have to be careful, though, to fold it up and put it back the way you found it. In any case, the point is, Rami Bar Tamli is saying to Rav Chista, since this garment is borrowed, and it's within 30 days, then I don't have to put tzitzis on it. And again, as Chassam Sofer says, it's not only I don't have to put tzitzis on it, but I can't, because that would already be, well, if I put tzitzis on it, then the other guy is going to have to leave them on there, and it's going to be a hefsid for him, and I can't do that. Okay. Meanwhile, the Gemara says, Adrahachi. So far, again, everything that Rav Chista threw at Rami, Bar Tamli, every challenge that he threw at him, Rami has an answer right on the spot. So then the Gemara says, Adrahachi, as they were talking, as they were discussing this whole matter, I see you, Allahu Gavra, they brought to Rav Chista's based in a certain person, that I have a moker over the ime, that he avu over ime, that he wasn't honoring his parents, he wasn't showing them the proper covered. Covered means not just to have a mental covered for them. It means the Gemara mentions in Kiddushin, it means to do actual things for them, give them food and drink and clothing and then so on and so forth. So this guy wasn't doing it. Kafsu, so they tied him to the post because they were going to give him Malkus. Now we're not talking about Malkus for a lav in the Torah. There's no lav in the Torah on this, but it means, in other words, they were going to give him basically Malkus Maudus. They were going to force him. They were going to give him Malkus to force him to do the Avera, to do the mitzvah. Namely, Rashi explains that based on a Gemara elsewhere, that when a person has a mitzvah saseh, which he's supposed to be doing, and he's not doing it, then Makinoisa agitates him after, then they beat him as much as necessary, even until his nefesh leaves him, and they're going to force him to do the mitzvah. So they thought they're going to do that, they're going to force him to do what he needs to do for his parents. Amalahu, but Rami Bar Tamri tells them, Shavkuhu, leave him alone, don't give him malchus to force him to do that. The Tanya, we learn in a braisa, Kol mitzvah sefer shein mashamat and schor betzideh. Any mitzvah saseh, where it says explicitly in the Torah, right after it says the mitzvah, it says the reward for it. So an example of that is Kibbutz Av V'Em, where right away the Torah says, Laman Yarif on Yamecha. So then, Ein Beistin Shlamatim Uzhorin Aleha, a Beistin down here on earth is not given the instructions that they have to force the guy to do it. Meaning, in other words, basically, we say like this. If the Torah doesn't say a schar, then fine. You have to, let's say, for example, sukkah or matzah or whatever. So then, so then there's a sukkah, lulav, whatever. So then makinois agitates in action. Because the Torah never specifies the reward for it. So do it. The Torah, Hashem says you have to do it. And if you don't want to do it, then we're going to beat you until you do it. The famous Rambam in Hilchos Gerushin that says every year, deep down, wants to do what Hashem wants, and therefore, and then the only reason he's not is because of the Yetzirah, so therefore beating him removes that Yetzirah and restores his original desire to do what Hashem wants. But Rami Bar Tamri points out, when the Torah mentions a reward together with it, then it's different. Then it amounts to saying, do this and you'll get this reward. And if you don't do this, your punishment will be, you don't get that reward. So then in that case, since the Torah says that Kibbutz Av V'Em, honor your parents in order that so fine, the guy doesn't want to live long, then he's not going to honor his parents. We don't have to force him. We don't have to force him into doing it. Tosfos points out that a counter example seems to be tzedakah, where you find there's a Gemara in Bava Basra that one time Rava forced somebody to give tzedakah. So Tosfos says two things. First of all, forced can mean he verbally compelled him to do it. He explained to him about how important it is. And also, tzedakah, there was a loisa, say, involved to not withhold your hand, as opposed to that kibbutz av v'em, there isn't. So in any case, for Rami Bar Tamri pointed out that in this case, this guy does not get malchus for it. With that said, there are rishonim who learned that Bastin could force the person if he wanted to. So in that case, Tosfos in Bava Basra explains that in fact they're not obligated to. So in other words, he's telling them you don't have to. So fine, if you want to, you could, but you're not obligated to. Well, after all this, so we see that Rami Bar Tamri is very, very sharp. He really is on the ball. Amalei, said of Chista says, Chazina lofta charifas tova. I see that you're very sharp. You know, you really have an answer. You have an answer for everything. Amalei. So Rami Bar Tamri answers him, I haveis ba'aswe de Rabbi Yehuda. If you were in the place of Rabbi Yehuda, who was my Rebbe, achvina lachulfoi, then I would show you my sharpness. So one way of looking at it is, in other words, here, I'm traveling, I'm on the road, and therefore I'm not as sharp and on the ball as I usually am, but if I were at home in Pumbedisa, then in fact that would be even better. Another way of looking at it is giving the credit to his Rebbe, Rabbi Yehuda, is the Rosh Hashiva in Pumbedisa. So he's saying, you think that I'm great, if you were to come to Pumbedisa and talk to Rabbi Yehuda, then you would see what real sharpness is. So actually, the Chassam Sofer has a couple of interesting explanations on this last part over here. It almost sounds like Rami Bar Tamri is boasting. Over here, I'm already great, but if I were there, I'd be even greater. So first of all, the Chassam Sofer gives an explanation. He says that, he explains like this. He's saying, Rav Chista is telling me, he's telling him, you seem to be so smart, so sharp, that you must have, when you came here to Surah, you probably planned to settle over here. You probably learned as much as you need to by Rabbi Yehuda, and now you're planning to settle here in Surah. Well then, we're back to the question, then why do you eat the udders? Because after all, here the minhag in Surah is to not eat them. You're telling me before you ate them outside the tomb, very nice, because you're only visiting over here, very nice. But if you're planning to settle over here, then you need to follow the local minhagim. And Rami answers him, no, on the contrary, you'll see that I'm capable of even greater sharpness when I'm back home in Pumbedisa. I'm only visiting over here. I have no intention of settling over here. I'm just visiting. When I return to Pumbedisa, I will go back to learning by Rabbi Yehuda, and I will continue working. I'm becoming even sharper and greater in Torah, and therefore I'm entitled to have eaten those udders in the beginning of the story. That's one point that Sam Sofer makes, and then he also goes on to say that each of these things, he explains that each of these questions kind of builds on the previous one. So So he goes like this. When Rami Bartamri is thinking to himself, when Rav Chisda asked me why I'm not wearing tefillin and why I'm not wearing tzitzis, well, isn't not wearing tzitzis something more serious? You're wearing a four corner garment, not putting tzitzis on it. You're actually being mevatel a mitzvah saseh. You're actually failing to do. You're actually doing something and failing to do the mitzvah saseh with it, as opposed to tefillin. As Shev Balta says, you're not doing something passively. So Rami has to think to himself, why is Rav Chisda asking me these questions in this order? So he understands that Rav Chisda holds that a person is not allowed to be machmir on himself when he's not chayav. So after he asked about the tefillin, and then Rami Bartamri explains that I'm chol me'ayin. So then, in turn, Rav Chisda understood that Rami holds that a person could be machmir on himself. So then in that case, he asked him, well, why weren't you machmir on yourself to wear tzitzis? And the answer is because that would be a chumrah on somebody else's expense. So now when it comes to forcing somebody to keep kibud av va'im, and he's telling him based on his culture to do that, and even though we're saying some opinions say they could, but Rav Chisda is saying that Rami Bartamri in effect is telling him it's true, Rav Chisda, you do have permission to whip this guy to make him do what he needs to do. However, you yourself hold, Rav Chisda, it comes out from the previous discussion that you hold when a person is culture from doing something, he shouldn't do it. So therefore you shouldn't be hitting this guy. So now Rav Chisda is very impressed that Rami Bartamri is able to figure out from the conversation what his shitta is in halacha about these kinds of things. So that's why now he says, I see that you're very sharp. And again, Rami Bartamri answers that this is nothing compared to the sharpness that you can find in Pumbedisa by Rabbi Yehuda. And when I'm there learning Torah, then that's a whole different level. So that's that as far as the tchal, as far as the utter. So the bottom line is, in other words, that the actual bottom line halacha, the chumrah of Rav that was saying that you can't eat utter at all was not accepted in the general Jewish world. Again, we're saying Rav had to do it in Bavel for specific reasons that apply over there. It doesn't apply necessarily across the board anywhere else. In practice, I don't know if you have anybody eats utter as kosher to meat nowadays. It's from the back half of the animal. And again, as you've learned before, the back half in general, we tend not to eat because of all the different things of chalev and gidanosha and other things that are found over there that are difficult to remove. But it is in principle mutter. And in Shulchan Aruch, there's a simen about it in your day, simen tzaddik, and it goes into the detail. So you have to, again, you have to rip it open, you have to press out the milk in it, and then you would be allowed to roast it and eat it. Or if you just ripped it in one direction, then you're allowed to roast it. If you rip it chesi ve'erev and press it onto the wall until there's really no moisture of milk with it left, then it will be mutter to cook it with meat. If you didn't rip it, then it doesn't matter whether it's from a baby animal or from an adult animal that's lactated, but you're not allowed to cook it. If you did cook it by itself, then as Tosfos says, then you would be b'dieved mutter to eat it. And if you cooked it with other meat, then you have b'shishim. And there, as we learned in a previous part of our Masechta, the chal itself counts as one of the 60. And then it goes on to say in Shulchan Aruch about the minig is not to cook it with other meat at all. And you do have to do this ripping and this pressing, etc. And you have different details about that. They have different details about what you can do as far as cooking and roasting it. Okay. Now we're going to go on to another topic. So here till now we've been talking about the cow, and the problem is again that it has a lot of milk in it, or at least at some stages of the animal's life it has a lot of milk in it, and therefore we have to be concerned about basar b'chalav. Now we have to consider about the liver. The liver is very, very saturated with blood, so much that as we learned yesterday when we had Yalta's statement about the various things the Torah asks to us and then is matzah to us. Incidentally, also there's an interesting, before we get to that, by the way, there's an interesting point about this story with Rami Bartamri that we just had right now about the udders. One point is that since, as we learned yesterday, in Yalta's statement, it comes out that the Torah is when is the Torah matur us to eat basar b'chalav is by eating an udder where there you have a little bit of a semblance of that. And one idea we talked about, why is it important to know that for everything that's usur, Hashem gave us something parallel that's mutter. One thing is it helps keep the Yetzer Hara at bay. Because it's the Yetzirah is going to tell you, wait a minute, you know, you're full going such a pleasure. Why are you doing that? Just ignore what Hashem says and have the pleasure anyway. And we tell the Yetzirah, absolutely not. There's something equally good that is perfectly mutter. And, you know, we don't have to, if we really want that experience, we don't have to violate what Hashem says. Well, therefore, on Erev Yom Kippur is a particularly good time for Romi Bar Tamri to be doing exactly that, and keep his Yetzirah at bay by saying, you Yetzirah are telling me I should be over on Basar B'Chalav. No, I'll eat others instead, and that way it'll be completely mutter. One other point also, the Maharam Shif makes a point about it. Wasn't there a problem of Basar Shemes Alam and Ayam that we learned in the previous parak about that when meat has been out of sight of a yid for any amount of time, then we're concerned it may have been substituted by other meat, or a wild bird of prey may have taken in and brought something else instead. And the answer is, because since this was Erev Yom Kippur, and we're saying many people were shechting kosher animals for meat for the Suda, then therefore that's a day, like, as we learned there, and that's such a day, it's a day when the overwhelming majority of the supply of kosher meat in the area is kosher meet, and therefore there's no problem of Basar Shemes Alam and Ayin. Okay. Anyway, so now on to the liver. So again, the liver is also saturated with blood, so much that, again, in Yalta's statement, she was saying that when the Torah says we're not allowed to eat blood, but instead we're allowed to eat liver, which is tantamount to the same thing. So now let's talk about the dinim of the liver, what we have to do with that in order to be able to eat it. So the most, and the way I buy a little sabra. So Abaya says to Rav Safra, "Ki salkas lahosam." When you go up to there to Eretz Yisrael, Rav Safra would regularly travel between Eretz Yisrael and Babel. Boy minayu, so Abaya tells him, "Ask the chacham over there, Kavda Ma'atun Bay. What do you chachamim hold about the liver? Are you allowed to just cook it? Are you allowed to cook it in a pot, or are you not allowed to because it exudes blood?" Now, again, Rashi explains, kule dam, in effect, the whole thing, the whole liver, is considered blood. But you could argue that as long as it's still in its place, then it's not really considered blood. It's not really considered to have the status of blood in halacha yet. But meanwhile, if you cook it, then it's going to exude, and then it's going to be reabsorbed, then it would be considered blood. So what do you chacham hold? Is there a problem with that, or are you allowed to cook it in a pot regular and eat it? That's the point of Rashi. Tosfos brings two possibilities to understand what we're talking about over here. One possibility, Tosfos says, is that we're talking about where it wasn't salted. Now, if you salted it, like you salt regular kosher meat, no question, says Rabbi Natan, that you should be allowed to cook it together with other meat. It extracts the blood, the usual kind of thing, and then people, in fact, do that. They roast it, and then they cook it, and that would be perfectly fine. And the same way as you can cook it after you roast it, the same way you could cook it after you salt it. So that's one possibility that Tosfos brings up of what the question is over here. So the question would be, if you didn't salt it, the dievet is it going to be also if you cooked it? Then the second possibility, Tosfos says, we're talking about, of course, if you didn't salt it, there's no question that's also. The question is, if you salt it, but since it has such an enormous amount of blood in it, maybe the regular salting process is not enough to get out the blood, or is it? So in fact, Tosfos, after discussing the different pros and cons of the different opinions, Tosfos point brings from the Rif, who says that the universal minhag of Jews is not to ever cook liver, even after salting it. You have to roast it first. You have to roast it. That will effectively extract enough of the blood. That will effectively extract the blood. And now after that, then after having roasted it, you could cook it. But otherwise not. So in practice, in Shulchan Aruch, I mean, so we'll go through the sugya over here, and then we'll talk about Be'ez Hashem, what it says in Shulchan Aruch, what you're able to do with it. So we have three different understandings of what the question was. According to Rashi, are you allowed to cook it in a pot? Are we concerned about the blood that it exudes? According to Rabbi Natan and Tosfos, if you didn't salt it and you cooked it, would it be also the Be'evet or not? And according to the second possibility in Tosfos, we're talking about where it was salted, but the question is the salting of liver enough to extract the blood like it would be with other meat? Okay, so the Gemara says, Ki Solik, so when Rav Safra went up to Eretz Yisrael, Ashkeche, Rav Zirka, so he found Rav Zirka, and he asked him this question. Omale, so Rav Zirka says, I can prove to you it's allowed, I'm not Shalki, Leila, Rav Ami, V'Ochal. One time I cooked a liver for Rav Ami, and he ate it. So you see that it's Moshe. He also Legabei, so later on when Rav Safra came back to Bavel and told Abaya, Amaleh, Abaya says, you misunderstood what I was asking about. L'meisim natural lekom aboyli. I have no question about it itself being osir or not. Because it's the concept that we call in halacha, I did Torah l'miflat le'bola. As long as it's exuding, it's not going to absorb. The liver is exuding blood during the cooking, and therefore it's not going to reabsorb it. So that wasn't my question in the first place. Kikom aboyli, l'meisim chavata. The question was, what about would it ask of other meat that it was cooked with? That other meat is not exuding, so maybe it's going to absorb the blood from the liver, or maybe not. This concept of Ivy Detora Lamithla, like Bala, we haven't really called it by name until now, but it comes up in these Sugyas of Tokas Tarugas, so we've touched on it a little bit here and there. It comes up in our Avodah as well. There's a well known question people asked in the early years of Shlichus and of Mifsoyim. Even nowadays, sometimes sporadically people ask the question, but it was much more common in the early days. How are you sending out people into the middle of nowhere Jewishly? Aren't you concerned that they're going to be affected by their environment? And the answer is this: I didn't heard of the mitzvah like Bala. You're busy exuding. You're giving forth teachings of the Rebbe, teachings of Chassidus, teachings of Torah. Then you're not going to absorb from your surroundings. But of course it has to be that the whole time you're exuding and you don't relax your vigilance and you don't allow yourself to be affected. So in any case, Rabbi says to Rav Safra, so you have to re-ask the question. The question was not whether the liver by itself is going to be ulcer, but whether it would ulcer other meat that it's cooked with. So Rav Safra says, Maishnah, Lamesa, Nafshad, Lemon, Bailach. Well, why is it? When it comes to ulcering itself, you have no question, and Ditnan, and the reason is, based on a Mishnah in Masechta Terumos that says Eino Ne'eseres, that says that the liver does not, that says in Masechta Terumos, it's talking about the main topic of Masechta Terumos about, of course, is about the dinim of Truma, but in the course of it, it ends up talking about cases where Truma was mixed with Chulin, and therefore indirectly, it ends up talking about certain dinim of Kashrus, certain dinim of mixtures of kosher and non-kosher as well. So now you have a Mishnah over there where it says that the liver will aser something else, the ain't an aseris, but it itself does not become also, because Pilatus, Reina Belas, again, this idea just heard of the Miflat Lebala, it's exuding and therefore doesn't absorb. So Safra asks, then if you know that Mishnah, then you're saying the Mishnah says over there, it ain't an aseris, the liver itself doesn't become also, Lemesa Chabacher, Nami Loti Bari Lachlo, then what are you asking? Whether it's going to aser something else. It's not, that same Mishnah says that covered aseris, liver will aser other meat that's cooked with it, because the blood that exudes out of it, the ain't an aseris, but it won't become also from its own blood, when things shake the lepus, because it's exuding blood, the ain't a belas, and therefore it's not absorbing. So what makes you think? So if you know that Mishnah, Then, if you know that Mishnah, that it's mutter, that it itself is mutter, then why are you asking whether it asks other meat? It's clear from that Mishnah that it is, in fact, that it does, in fact, answer it. Which Tosfos brings up the question that in that case, why didn't Rav Safra bring this up to begin with? When Abaya first told him, when you go to Eretz Yisrael, bring them this question, right away then Rav Safra shouldn't have pointed out, don't you know that Mishnah? So Tosfos says, fine, but maybe he didn't know, Abaya didn't know, what about if it was shluka, if it was cooked a lot? Maybe, in other words, you would say, it's one thing, regular bishul, regular cooking, so fine, you know, fine, it's exuding, doing the cooking, and therefore you're saying, like, bala, it won't absorb. But shlika means overcooking, means stewing. And here it's not stewing with S-T-I-R-R-I-N-G like we had the other day, but stewing a pot. Here we're talking about stewing, S-T-E-W-I-N-G, as in actually cooking it for a long time. Maybe you could argue there comes a point when it stops exuding and then it's going to start absorbing from its own blood. So then he tells him, well, Rav Zvika says that he one time cooked one for a pasi and he ate it. So and that was shalkile. He uses the same word shaluk, which means cooked, stewed, and nevertheless it was mutter. So therefore, sort of Safra figured that that was it. So Abaya says, but no, the Stam Mishnah says over there that it itself does not become osir in at all. But then, so now Rav Safra asks him, well, if you know that Mishnah, then why aren't you inferring from it right away that the liver is going to osir other meat that's cooked with it? And what are you asking the question for in the first place? And the answer is Amalei. So Abaya answers Duma Hasan B'Kavda De'Isura, because who says that Mishnah is talking about a liver that intrinsically is mutter from a kosher animal? Maybe it's talking about a liver, for example, from an animal that is not kosher. For example, that for an animal that the animal was a treifa. Or Mishum Shamnu Nisa. So then the problem is when we say that an aser is whatever else it cooks with it, it's not because of the blood. It's because of the fattiness. The fattiness of it, which is intrinsically also because this is a treif animal. So that fattiness itself is also in that would aser the other meat that it's cooked with. Meaning, in other words, maybe the Mishnah is saying like this: the if the liver is mutter, then ainu ne'aseres, it doesn't become us become aser. And even if it's cooked with a tray for one, it also wouldn't become aser because it's exuding the blood that's in it, and therefore it's not going to absorb. But on the other hand, the question is, maybe the Mishnah is saying that it will aser others, namely where it itself is not kosher because it comes from a tray, and it'll aser it not because of the blood, but because of the fattiness. My question is, Mishum Jamamai. But what about the blood? And what about the blood in a kosher liver? Would that be a problem, and would it aser the other pieces? Okay, Kihodr Solik, so when Reb Safra went to Eretz Yisrael again, Ashchel Reb Zirka, so again he met Reb Zirka, and asked him this follow-up question, Omale, and Reb Zirka tells him, Hai Nami Leiti Barilach, that also you should have no reason to ask about, and I'll tell you an answer. Danov Yanai Breder Reb Ami, I and Yanai, the son of Reb Ami, Iklon Lebed of Yehuda Breder Reb Shimon Pazi, one time we visited the house of Yehuda, the son of Reb Shimon Pazi, the Kariva Lung, Kanya Bekufe Va'achalna. They brought us a Kanya Bekufe and we ate it. Kanya Bekufe means Kanya, means the windpipe. Bekufe means with whatever else. Bekufe literally means in its basket. So it means with the other parts of the animal that are attached to it. So Rashi explains, in other words, this was the windpipe and the lungs and the heart and the liver, all of them together were cooked together as one big thing in a pot. Va'achalna, and we ate it. So you see, therefore, that not only the liver itself was not also, but it didn't aser the other meats that were with it as well. So therefore, so you see from that also that so you can answer Abaya's follow-up question. Not only is the liver itself not going to be also if you cooked it, but it's not even going to aser the other meat that it's cooked with. But Maskus of Ashi, but Rav Ashi questions that. He came from Shmuel Mizarukinia, or some say Rav Shmuel from Zarukinia, asked the question. How do you know? Maybe in that case, the Duma Pikona Chutzpah Zerahava, maybe when they cooked it, they made sure that the tip, that the outer end of the windpipe was outside the pot. Now, therefore, what's going to happen is all the blood vessels are going to then drain out through that. And therefore, so that would be why it doesn't become ulcer, because it has a place to drain out. But when you're cooking in a regular pot and it's all contained within the pot, then you could say that then you have a problem. Then you have a problem. The blood remains in the pot and it can ulcer at least the other pieces that are with it. So how is that a proof? Now, an interesting point that comes of this is, back in Perek Elu Treifis, in the third Perek of Amasechta, we talked about, there was a Gemara there on Daf Mem Hei that mentioned Tlosa Kani Havu. There are three pipes in the chest, and that has certain implications as far as the halachas of Treifis. So we said each one, there's one from the heart that has the same dinim as the heart as far as a puncture in it, one that comes from the lungs and has the same din as the lungs, one that comes from the liver and has the same din as the liver. And we talked about it a little bit about over there, different opinions about what those three pipes are. The implication of the way the Gemara seems to phrase it over there is that one of them connects to the other, but it's a little hard to understand because at least some, for example, we're talking about there the windpipe, which carries air, versus you have some blood vessels, the aorta or the vena cava or whatever, which carry blood, and they don't seem to be interconnected. So on the face of it, what do you mean over here that they add this whole thing together, and therefore the blood is able to drain out through the windpipe? How would it do that if there's no connection between them? So actually, the Sichas Cholin, this is the Sefer with diagrams and explanations on Masechta Cholin, a very comprehensive Sefer, we've quoted it many times in this shiur throughout this Masechta, he says that he actually tried the experiment. He actually literally tried that. Kanya Bekufe, cooking it in a pot with the end of the windpipe outside, and sure enough, blood poured out. So apparently, apparently, even though while it's alive, of course, you're not going to have blood, it's not going to flow into the windpipe, but when it's cooked, then the cooking doesn't indeed causes the blood vessels and the other things to break down over there, and therefore blood can in fact flow out, and therefore that's what Rav Ashi or Shmuel Mizaruknia are saying, that maybe they did that, and therefore that would make it allowed, but not necessarily if it was cooked in a closed pot. inami, or even another possibility, mechat havacholot leneikra, another possibility, it could even be that before they cooked it, they put it in vinegar, and the vinegar causes it, causes the blood vessels to close up. So that way the blood remains where, that way the blood remains, it can be vinegar, it can be boiling hot water, is another possibility as well. And therefore, so now in effect, the blood gets cooked in place, and now when you cook it together with other meat, it's not going to exude out and assur the other meat. Interestingly, the Rambam holds that the chlal, after you salt and kasher meat, the Rambam holds you have to then dunk it in boiling hot water in order that no more blood will exude out of it. All the other Rishonim disagree with the Rambam on that, and I don't know that there's anybody who holds that way nowadays. And we say once meat is properly salted and washed and everything else, then anything that exudes out of it after that is not considered, is not blood anymore. At that point, it's just meat juices. Okay. In any case, the point is, Rav Ashi, or Rav Shmuel Mezarokinya are saying you don't really have a solid proof, therefore, that in that case they cooked it in such a way that there would even be a question of, that there would be a question of kashrus, because maybe they had a way to prevent the blood from being absorbed into the other things by keeping the end of the windpipe outside the pot, or by dunking the liver to begin with in boiling water or in vinegar. As in fact, the Gemara says, Ki hod Rav Huna chalti le b'chala, Rav Nachman chalti le b'roisken, as we find just that. For Rav Huna, before they cooked the liver for him, they would first dunk it and keep it a while in vinegar to close up the blood vessels. And for Rav Nachman, they would put it in boiling water. So you see that once you do that, then it's allowed to cook. Now, Tosfos points out, well, in that case, doesn't that show that without that, it's also two? So in that case, then that at least would answer that question. And the answer is maybe they have the same suffix, and therefore there would be machmir. Now, again, Tosfos says, if just to eat it by itself, it wouldn't be a problem. But the question is, they wanted to make sure it doesn't ask for other meat that it's cooked with. So in that connection, then the Gemara mentions Sover a Papa Hamed the Rav Lamema. Now a Papa, looting of the Talmud in front of Rava, he thought to say Chala Osir, that if you do that, if you put the liver in vinegar, then fine, the liver itself afterwards you'll be able to cook, no problem. But the vinegar itself will be Osir because a little blood exudes into it while the liver is soaking in it. Amalei, Rava says no, Ichala Osir, Yunami Osir. No, if the vinegar was going to be Osir, the liver itself would be Osir as well. Kihech de Polit Hadabala. Because just as it exudes, so it absorbs. So again, in other words, you would say a little bit exudes out into the vinegar, and then afterwards, when you're finished, there comes a point when it stops exuding. I did the Torah Mithlat. There comes a point when it stops exuding, and at that point, bola, it could conceivably absorb. The fact that we're not worried about that shows that that's not a problem, and therefore you would in fact be allowed to do that. Now, we'll go through. We're going to continue tomorrow, Beis Hashem. We're going to talk more about more of these detailed dinim of the liver. In practice, in Shulchan Aruch mentions that it starts by saying that because it has so much blood, so b'hatchila, you can't just do melicha, you can't just salt it, you have to rip it shesi ve'erev, you have to also cut it shesi ve'erev, and have the cut flowing downward, going downward, and then you can roast it, and then after that you could cook it, or the Rama mentions you can also make a lot of holes in it, that would be the equivalent of shesi ve'erev. And then you have a detailed dinim of what happens if you cook it by itself, that it itself will be mutter, but the pot will be osir, because the pot is going to absorb, and yesh misha osir, some say that it's osir, and then Ramah says that's the minhag, even if you did salt it beforehand, and then you have these dinim about putting it in vinegar or boiling hot water, so it's allowed, although the goyim asked to do it, because the water might not be so boiling, or the vinegar might not be strong enough, or whatever, and then you have various details that it continues to talk about what happens if you did roast it or cook it together with other meat, then you have various dinim in that regard.